Russian interference and political persecution are now certain to dangerously divide the country. Trump can still run for the presidency even if convicted, and most analysts say a conviction appears unlikely. However, Democrats appear to be betting that the disgrace of being the first indicted president ever will be enough to tip the scales in what will likely be a tightly contested vote in 2024. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Caskets draped in Iranian flags and carried in a mass procession. People from all walks of life following the trucks carrying the coffins of Milad Haydari and Mehrdad Mehrani, making their way to Tehran's Shuhada Square from Imam Hussein Square, where the funeral ceremony began just a few hours earlier.
All of those who have attended the funeral are here to renew their allegiance to the values that these martyrs sacrificed their lives to uphold.
We are here to show that we will continue backing the Islamic Republic. The huge crowds that you see here have gathered today to thank our martyrs for the sacrifices they made.
The Iranian IRGC military advisors were martyred in Friday's aerial assaults conducted by Israel on the suburbs of Damascus. Haydari, a 32-year-old father of two, was from Kurdistan province, and Mehrani, 31, who later succumbed to his wounds, had a 2-year-old son.
I personally came here because my brother was murdered, and I strongly believe in the choice that they made. This murder will never be forgotten.
Attending this ceremony is the least we could do to send a strong message to the world, particularly to our enemies. It's also a token of our gratitude for what the martyrs have done and the sacrifices they've made.
We will support the Islamic Revolution to the last drop of our blood. We will support our leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and no matter what happens, we will always support our martyrs.
Men and women in black followed them, weeping for the martyrs that sacrificed their lives in the fight against terrorism in the region. But most importantly, they are here to once again pledge allegiance to the values these martyrs died for.
Huge masses gathered downtown Tehran in Imam Hussein Square to bid farewell to the two martyrs and also to tell the world that they will continue to walk down their path. Ahmadi, Tehran.
A selection of rare manuscripts of the Holy Quran, which have been calligraphed and illuminated centuries ago, has been put on display in an exhibition in Pakistan. The week-long exhibition, organized by the cultural section of Iran's embassy in Islamabad, showcases dozens of rare manuscripts of the Holy Quran, written by prominent Iranian and Pakistani artists. Over 40 historical Quran manuscripts kept by the Iran-Pakistan Persian Language Studies Center have been put on display at the event.
Islam's holy book, the Holy Quran, was revealed in its entirety to Prophet Muhammad some 40 centuries ago during the fasting month of Ramadan. That is why this exhibition takes place during the holy month.
The organizers of the exhibition emphasize the youth of today should be made aware of Quran's significant importance.
The key purpose of this exhibition is to get people more familiar with Quran. Muslims need each other's help to solve their current issues, and Quran is the ideal tool for doing so because it is the pillar of Muslim solidarity.
Participants in the opening ceremony say the exhibition can be appealing to the students and artists and also help develop cultural cooperation between Iran and Pakistan.
The manuscripts of Quran displayed here show the depth of attention and familiarity of our past with the Holy Quran. One of the goals of this exhibition is to promote the teachings of our divine book, especially among the younger generation.
The exhibition, which will run till April 7th, is expected to attract a large number of visitors as it provides an opportunity for Muslims to learn about the latest studies on the impact of Quranic teachings on everyday life. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
As International Quds Day approaches, large billboards with the theme of Iftar in Quds have been going up across the capital, Kabul. The goal is to support occupied Al-Quds and the Palestinian nation. People of Afghanistan consider Al-Quds as a source of religious unity and brotherhood against hegemonic powers or the global arrogance.
Quds.
Al-Quds is in the hearts of all Muslims, as it's the first Qibla in Islam. Palestine and Al-Quds are a factor for awakening and uniting Muslims. All Muslims should know that the global arrogance is behind the issue of Palestine, that makes Al-Quds a symbol of the fight against arrogant powers and bullies for Muslim nations worldwide.
Supporting the Palestinian nation is an issue that the people of Afghanistan have always insisted on. The people here hope that in the not-too-distant future, the Palestinian nation and the Holy Quds will be freed from the occupation of the Zionist regime.
I personally wish that I visit that area one day, but I hope that they come soon and Palestine and Jerusalem and every other area in that geography that once belonged to the Palestine, the state of Palestine and its people should be free.
The Israeli regime has in recent months stepped up its atrocities, killing around 100 Palestinians this year alone.
The people of Afghanistan are against the Israeli occupation of Palestine. This is also as they have endured tyranny and are familiar with the crimes committed during the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan for over two decades. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Large field kitchen has become a usual scene in Ramadan every year since the war started in Syria. An NGO named Saad has been cooking warm meals for the needy in the fasting month for over a decade now. This year, they have expanded their massive kitchens in four Syrian cities, making over 20,000 meals for free.
This is our 11th year. This year is different from all previous ones as we faced earthquakes in Aleppo. Our kitchens were established directly at that time, even before Ramadan. People's needs are doubling this year. People depend on us now every year. About 20,000 meals are produced daily.
The organization depends on donations, both cash and food supplements. Volunteers arrive early in the day to prepare, plan, and cook a specific meal to be distributed before sunset. Zahra says every capable Syrian should shoulder some responsibility to help others during this crisis.
I feel related to this initiative in Ramadan every year. I can't imagine myself not helping during this month. It feels incredibly good to know I'm helping in feeding thousands of people. It's a responsibility and an expression of love to my people.
We start working every day at 9 a.m. We prepare the ingredients of the meal, such as meat, rice, and vegetables. We produce the meals, wrap them, and distribute them to the needy, mainly in poor areas and earthquake-affected parts of Syria.
The recent earthquakes exacerbated the already tough economic conditions in Syria. The UN says 70% of the population needs humanitarian assistance, while 6.8 million people have been internally displaced. Syrians have endured almost all factors that could bring a person to the brink of poverty, from foreign-backed war and terrorism to U.S. and Western economic sanctions and the recent devastating earthquakes. In this unprecedented scenario, such initiatives are sometimes life-saving for the poor and constitute a message of unity among Syrians. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Top NGOs gathered in the United States for a peace summit with the stated goal of fighting the war machine. The forum sought to empower and organize activists to stop U.S.-backed wars in Palestine, Yemen, Ukraine, and elsewhere, but they know that cultural resistance to peace appears deep.
We in the U.S. are so ingrained that domination of the world is our right. And, you know, being a nation founded on genocide, founded on slavery and those types of things, domination is just kind of in the air, and it seems normal, but it's really not normal.
Last month marked the 20th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. The war is widely considered a disaster, even within the United States, and yet Washington's foreign policy remains just as belligerent.
In 2002, polls showed that 67% of Americans disapproved of taking military action against Iraq. But then-Senator Joe Biden led the Democratic Party's bipartisan effort to invade. As president, Biden has stifled peace efforts, sent massive amounts of arms, and created a new quagmire, this time in Ukraine.
Well, we don't really have democracy. We have a state that calls itself a democracy. Biden just had a democracy summit. But we have a rigged system. We're allowed to vote. But that process is in itself corrupt. It gives the impression that we have input when we do not. The people don't have representation in this country. Defense contractors do, real estate developers do, Big Pharma does, but the people do not.
However, we're a long way from 2002. Many speakers noted the newfound inability of Washington to act unilaterally, which many around the world view as a positive.
And now you have other countries around the world. You have China, Russia, Iran, India. We have these emerging countries that represent regional threats, only because these countries now have the ability to chart their own paths of independent development. And that is very concerning to the United States and its goals of, you know, world hegemony.
The United States has existed for 246 years and been at war for 228 of them. They have nearly 800 military bases stationed in over 40% of the world's nations. Washington's war machine is strong, but activists say the average American's desire for peace is far stronger. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
A British public school in London has sparked controversy amid furious parent complaints that their children are being prevented from performing obligatory Islamic prayers during school hours. Michaela Community School in Wembley have been accused of blatant Islamophobia after students allegedly informed parents of several incidents which saw teachers interrupting praying pupils in an apparent attempt to ban Muslim worship. News first broke of the scandal after a petition was launched demanding that the school provide a prayer space for students. The petition lists examples of what allegedly took place.
On Thursday, the 23rd of March, students at Michaela were performing their obligatory prayers at the schoolyard. The pupils were praying on their prayer mats, and the teacher approaches the students and tells them to stop praying. She then says, "You need to leave your Islamic cultures alone. This is the West." She then tells them that they're not allowed a prayer mat at this school, and she says if she sees this again, she will give them a detention. One of the students praying was then excluded.
The story is concerning enough on its own, but what makes matters worse is that it's far from the only example of a UK school apparently showing signs that it may have a problem with its religious Muslim students. Over the past 24 months, multiple other examples have popped up across the country with schools facing similar accusations.
In December 2021, Manchester's Oldham Academy School apologised after students felt forced to pray outside in the cold. In January 2022, Park High School in Stanmore went viral over footage allegedly showing a teacher attempting to halt Jummah prayers. While this year has also seen two Birmingham-based schools embroiled in a row over LGBT propaganda lessons, seemingly targeting Muslim students in an attempt to change their understanding of Islam's position on same-gender relationships.
Don't remain silent, don't suffer in silence. So in specific cases like these, school kids need to record these incidents and write down witness statements ASAP and then get parents and police involved, because when the shoe is on the other foot and a Muslim child is accused of extremism, police are called in against you. Equality cuts both ways. And the bigger picture, it needs to involve a sustained effort by the Muslim community to abnormalize Islamophobia in media and politics. So irrelevant politicians and journalists who have nothing useful to say to society stop benefiting from dividing us.
Micaiah Community School has so far not responded to the story. But with so many similar incidents of alleged Islamophobia occurring in UK schools, the toxic atmosphere is likely part of a much bigger problem. Robert Carter, London.
A new report by the UNHCR has revealed that women's businesses in Afghanistan are severely affected by the Taliban's increasing restrictions. The report shows a sharp decline of women's participation in the labor market from 28% to 7%, and the consequent impact on the Afghan economy, that is witnessing a 30 to 35% drop in GDP in the past 2 years.
We Afghan women can help Afghanistan economy and people's livelihood grow. Afghanistan is a rich country, especially when it comes to agricultural minerals and handicraft. Afghan women can play a vital role in developing these sectors and contributing to national incomes. However, they need more opportunities and support to lead their business and pursue their passions. This means they need work license, freedom of movement, and access to local and global market.
Here in the women's market in Kabul, we spoke with some business women who told us their stories of hardship and resilience amid the Taliban's limitations. They say they're losing customers and opportunities which are meant to develop their businesses. Some of them have experienced a significant drop in their income, while others fear they may have to shut down their businesses soon.
Unfortunately, the Taliban's restrictions on women have wiped out educational and business opportunities. Women can't work in such a limited environment. Here in the women's market, we are receiving fewer customers, contractors, and funds than ever before. My fellow entrepreneurs are desperate, with some aiming to close their shops and end activities.
Many NGOs have stopped working with business women after the Taliban banned NGOs' female workers. These NGOs used to help us with getting work permits, finding contractors, and supplying some essentials. But all these supports are gone. As a result, we are operating at a loss since we have to pay for farmers' wages and production costs without any income.
Emphasizing the need for women's economic empowerment, UNHCR has called on the Taliban to respect and safeguard the rights to work and education for women. The agency has also appealed to the international community to sustain its support for humanitarian and development initiatives that benefit women and girls in Afghanistan. The plight of Afghan business women is just one example of how Afghan women are impacted by the Taliban restrictions. Now it's a matter of time that whether the de facto authorities will change their policies against women. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In the limelight.
U.S. companies are expanding in China. Major U.S. companies, from food giants to fashion brands, are increasing their bets on China's huge market in anticipation of Chinese consumers' willingness to spend their excess savings and a quick rebound for the world's second biggest economy. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of WARC.com has covered this story and tells us more. As China reopens and its consumer activity appears to improve, major U.S. companies are once again looking to the country as a key source of growth. Following the end of the zero-COVID policy that had seen China become a patchwork of different standings, some cities open, others closed, often at extremely short notice, China and the United States are evaluating what they could do for each other from a business and economic point of view. For multinationals, China has been a vital source of growth at a time of slowing growth across the Western world. Pre-pandemic U.S. gross domestic product had hovered around the 2-3% annual growth mark, while China's gross domestic product had hovered around 7-8%. While this growth slowed to just 3% in 2022, a return is expected, even if there are numerous policy challenges that the country must address, ranging from a property slump to a slowing export market around the world. Other observers anticipate a wave of revenge spending. But concerns are growing both over the geopolitical situation between the United States and China, as well as the post-pandemic economic uncertainty that has affected the country. Tensions are not to be sniffed at as merely political problems. Marketers will have to contend with local brand preferences and a need for a deep sensitivity in communications from foreign brands. The Wall Street Journal has recently reported that McDonald's plans to open 900 new stores in China this year, while Starbucks plans to open 3,000 new stores by the middle of this decade. Luxury and fashion looks to the recovery of the sector's largest market, China. Ralph Lauren has been gearing up for the reopening by focusing its new store openings in China, according to its most recent quarter. Burberry and Cartier have also noted growing sales in the country. In the packaged food industry, Tyson Foods and Hormel Foods are expanding their facilities in China, with the latter reported in the Chinese press to be building a new factory outside of Shanghai. The return of Chinese travelers is also expected to be globally significant for travel industry, as recent noises from Airbnb have suggested. The Chinese newspaper The Global Times has also covered this story and tells us more. Major U.S. companies, from food giants to fashion brands, are increasing their bets on China's huge market in anticipation of Chinese consumers' willingness to spend their excess savings and a quick rebound for the world's second biggest economy after China optimized its COVID-19 management. Despite the U.S. government's push for an economic decoupling from China, the actions of U.S. businesses have showed that they still see China as a market with massive opportunities, while many other economies face a slowdown, according to experts. Some American companies have announced their plans to expand operations in China, according to the Global Times. For example, in the packaging industry, Tyson Foods is planning to open two new plants in Nantong, East China's Jiangsu province, and Shaogan, Central China's Hubei province, in the first half of this year. Tyson Foods China and Korea said in a statement shared with the Global Times on Tuesday, 28th of February. U.S. retailer Tapestry, the owner of the Coach and Kate Spade brands, is teaming up with local brand White Rabbit to expand in the Chinese market. The Chinese market is the inexhaustible source of inspiration for the company to seek breakthroughs and innovation. We hope that through more such innovative cooperation, we can bring consumers new inspiration for a better life and bring new strength to the innovation and development of China's fashion industry. Yan Bozek, president of Tapestry Asia Pacific and the chief executive officer and president of Coach China, said in a statement sent to the Global Times. And Starbucks aims to increase the number of its stores in China to 9,000 and double its net income in China by 2025, according to a statement shared with the Global Times. The expansions come as China optimizes its pandemic management along with growing Chinese household deposits over the past 3 years and plans to boost consumption as a main driver of the economy this year. U.S. businesses, particularly those in the consumption field, are setting their sights on China's huge market opportunities in 2023 and beyond. Hu Qimu, chief research fellow at the Sino-Steel Economic Research Institute, told the Global Times on Tuesday, 28th of February. According to the People's Bank of China, the central bank, deposits held by households nationwide grew in 2022 by a record 17.8 trillion yuan, a steep rise compared with the growth of 9.9 trillion yuan in 2021. The chief executive officer of Hong Kong Exchange and Clearing, Nicholas Aguzin, said he sees about $2.5 trillion in excess savings that could be used by Chinese households in post-pandemic period. According to Swiss firm UBS estimates, Chinese families accumulated 4 trillion yuan of excess savings between 2020 and 2022. With the optimized pandemic management introduced at the end of last year, pent-up consumption could be quickly unleashed to spur economic development, Hu Qimu said. From the perspective of U.S. markets, persistent inflation there weighs on consumer spending, pushing American companies to adjust their global market layouts and seek alternative markets with steady income. China's economy is likely to grow by 5.2% this year, and a key reason for the rebound this year will be an increase in consumer spending, Stephen Allen Barnett, senior International Monetary Fund resident representative in China, said in a recent interview with the Global Times. Stephen Allen Barnett added, "We estimate 1 percentage point more growth in China fuels 0.3 percentage points of growth elsewhere. This was the average impact. Countries that have closer trade links to China would benefit more." The appetite of U.S. companies to invest in China comes as the U.S. government has stepped up scrutiny over U.S. investment and business operations in China. A U.S. congressional panel plans to look at the role of private equity, venture capital, and Wall Street firms in China as it prepares to launch hearings on Tuesday, 28th of February, according to the Financial Times. The noise from U.S. politicians is unlikely to turn into actual bills or actual laws, and it is more for show. In the consumer sector, the so-called economic decoupling will affect the core interests of the companies, Hu Qimu added.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli police beating Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque and outlets.
Israel police said that they had entered to dislodge, quote, agitators, but that could not be further from the truth. Hamas has called this an unprecedented crime, and the Arab League, at the request of Jordan, held an emergency meeting in a show of Arab unity against Tel Aviv. The Arab League urged the UN Security Council to take action to stop such Israeli aggression, which is aimed at changing the status quo of the holy site. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the Al-Aqsa Mosque desecration by Israel, why Israel prevents Palestinian prayers in this Muslim holy site, and a look at the bigger picture when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Saad Nimr is a professor of political science who joins us from Birzeit University. Also joining us is Charlotte Cates, international coordinator at Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who joins us from Vancouver. Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Saad Nimr. Obviously, this was words fail to describe the way that these Palestinians were treated at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But first, I'll start with a general question. What gives Israel the right to attack and to desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque, which included the beating of these worshippers?
It's quite clear that what would give the Israeli the right to do that, it's the nature of the coalition of Netanyahu's government. We have to remember that two members, two parties in the coalition of this government are the religious Zionist parties, who are pressurizing, you know, Netanyahu over lots of other things, and Netanyahu could not do anything about it. Because otherwise he will lose his position as a prime minister. So this is a kind of a work of the right, very right fascist wing in Israel, which is like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who wanted to, and they are both settlers, and they want the settlers to get into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ben-Gvir statement lately, he said that Al-Aqsa Mosque is not only for the Muslims, it's for even also for the Jews, which is quite clear about, you know, the partition of the Al-Aqsa Mosque between the Palestinians and the Jews and or the Israelis in such case. And now they are calling for a huge incursions on Al-Aqsa Mosque in the coming few days because it's the Easter feast for the Jews in nowadays. And it started tomorrow, and they want a huge amount of settlers to get into Al-Aqsa Mosque. So because of all that, the attack last night was to get all the Palestinian prayers out of the mosque because they want to do the incursion on the, in the morning, and they don't want anyone to be there. Last night, there was more than 70,000 Palestinian prayers for the last prayers, and wait, and some of them were waiting also in the mosque for the morning prayers, and sure, those who were attacked by the Israeli police.
Well, Charlotte Cates, we need to, have you tell us or differentiate for us the narrative here, because what the media, many of the Western media, is claiming is that Israeli forces have clashed with Palestinian worshippers inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Well, that's not the way that it's gone down. I mean, the scenes speak for themselves, and the facts speak for themselves. You have Palestinian, they're worshippers, they go inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and then you have the security forces beating them. And these were some violent scenes. These beatings were quite cruel. I mean, they were quite violent. They were very graphic. I don't know if you've seen the videos. I'm sure you have. Beating them on the head. This is one eyewitness. They attacked the people, beating them on the head with sticks. People fainted. People suffocated. People were bleeding. And then they started arresting them, which we have the count to be 500. So this narrative for there to be clashes is a false one, isn't it?
This depiction by the media is clearly a reflection of the way that Western corporate mainstream media attempts to distract from the issue that there is clearly an oppressed people who are defending themselves and an oppressor that is using the most brutal attacks on people who are praying and remaining in Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan. And there's an attempt to forcibly remove Palestinian worshipers from the mosque in order to make way for violent fanatic settlers to invade and not just perform rites in Al-Aqsa Mosque, but threaten its destruction. So there's no equal balance here. The issue itself is just reflected in what we see in those horrible scenes from those videos, is that very fundamental inequality where you have people practicing their right to their religious beliefs on their own land and being assaulted brutally by a colonial occupier that wants to strip even that basic humanity from Palestinians and is failing to do so. There were hundreds of Palestinians thrown onto the grounds of the mosque, rounded up. Palestinians that were kneeling to pray were forcibly assaulted by occupation police forces in order so that a few fanatical settlers could enter into Al-Aqsa Mosque and threaten its destruction. What on earth does this represent other than the most brutal and bare form of colonialism before the world? While there has been an increasing number of condemnations, because how can you look at that video and not see what the reality is? Unfortunately, the United States, the European Union, Canada continue to sell weapons to Israel, continue to provide it with funds, continue to provide it with arms, and to continue to enable these colonial crimes to continue on a daily basis.
Yeah, perhaps you, of all people, I'm sure, can explain to us, Saad Nimr, what is the, the rule of law when it comes to praying at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in terms of Muslims, if you can give us a little bit of a background here, because it's supposed to be only for Muslims, but we understand that if you're a foreigner visiting Israel and you go to Al-Quds, you could enter the mosque, and Palestinians can't enter their own mosque as a Muslim. So tell us what restrictions Israel has placed. Give us a little bit of a background information here.
Absolutely right. But I would like first to add just one sentence for the last question. The number of the soldiers and the police forces who entered Al-Aqsa Mosque was huge, which means that it was prepared beforehand. It doesn't mean that there was a clash. They were preparing for this session of attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It was not a clash as it was viewed in some of the media, but we know that the media is a hypocrite and a double standard. However, for the laws about how to go into Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we are talking about Ramadan now, and especially with the thousands and thousands of Palestinians from everywhere would like to get in. First of all, for the Palestinian Jerusalemite, they can go at any time because it's any age, because they are Jerusalemite and they have the ID which is indicating that they are from Jerusalem. Now, for the Palestinians from outside Jerusalem, they laws on the roadblocks, which they block the Palestinians. For men, it should be 55 years old, and women over 40 years old to let them enter to Jerusalem and consequently to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that's only on Fridays. Other days, no, they are not allowed to. Now, the other set of laws concerning Al-Aqsa Mosque, Al-Aqsa Mosque is closed for the Palestinians totally from 7 o'clock in the morning till almost 12 in the afternoon or in the noon, because this time is made for the settlers to go into the mosque. And they try to choose the time where there's no prayer between the morning prayer and the dhuhr prayer, the lunch prayer. And then for the foreigners, they can get during that time also with the Israelis or with the settlers at the same time. They can visit Al-Aqsa Mosque unless they are coming with Palestinians, and in such case they can go through the other gates. But this gate, which is Al-Magharbi gate, it's designated only for the settlers and it's used only by the settlers and some of the foreigners. So foreigners, yes, could come at any time, not only to Al-Aqsa Mosque, even to Jerusalem. And I've so many times have said that even to my students, you know, international students, I mean, that you can go to Jerusalem whenever you like as a foreigner. And I live only 14 kilometers from Jerusalem and I can't get there. So it's quite, you know, these laws concerning the Palestinians to pray or to go to Jerusalem or to be in the city. What's the plan by the Israelis and this fascist government is to prevent and to isolate Jerusalem from its environment, which is the Palestinian cities and villages around Jerusalem, which now became behind the wall and it's not considered as part of Jerusalem or part of the district.
Could you hold on there? So let me go to Charlotte Cates. Charlotte Cates, we're looking at, obviously, this to be in conjunction with the beginning of Passover. One of the things that has been called by these settlers is quite actually, I'm not too sure, surprising or shocking. They have asked, and I'm wondering why, from you, if you can explain to us why this is so controversial, because they have said that they have allocated sums of money. This movement by the name of the Return to the Mount, they've allocated sums of money as rewards for settlers who attempt to make a sacrifice at the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Passover, and it's around $7,000, which would be paid, and $700 if they are arrested inside of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Can you explain to us what's going on in their head, and why is this controversial?
Well, first of all, it says a lot that in order to supposedly perform a religious rite, which would ostensibly be performed out of dedication to God, these organizations are offering to pay people $7,000 in order to do it, which is a significant sum of money. And what that indicates is that the purpose of this is not some form of religious worship of God, but of a deliberate planned criminal provocation targeting the Palestinian people, targeting the holy sites of the Palestinian people, and specifically targeting Muslims in general. The purpose is to claim through this religious expression some sort of alleged Jewish dominion or recreation of the temple on the grounds of Al-Aqsa Mosque. But what this fundamentally is, beyond the religious trappings, is one of the barest and most obvious and blatant forms of colonial assault on the Palestinian people. This is not about freedom of religion or freedom of worship. If it were, there wouldn't be any need for the $7,000 bribe. What this is instead is an attempt to essentially hire mercenaries to attack the Palestinian people from among the settler forces. Because when we talk about settlers and what they are, really what we're talking about are groups of paramilitaries, heavily armed individuals carrying out the violence of colonialism against the Palestinian people, whether this is invading holy sites, whether this is attempting to destroy homes, whether this is uprooting olive trees and burning crops. All of these are these forms of paramilitary settler violence that operate hand in hand with the official state violence of the occupation army.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, one of the other goals, which is one of the major ones here, Saad, I'll never correct me if I'm wrong, is that it wants to take away the Islamic identity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. I think that's one of the goals that Israel does have. And, of course, the settlers are very much into doing that. It is said that that is one of the aims here. Tell us the different ways that we've seen this happen in terms of taking away the Islamic identity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Yes, absolutely. That's what happened in Hebron with the Ibrahimi Mosque. When the settler insisted, and after the massacre of 1994, when they divided the Ibrahimi Mosque into two parts, part for Jews and part for Muslims, though the mosque is an Islamic site. And now it's happening again in the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the same way. Al-Aqsa consists of 144 square dunams. in total, all of it. Now the settlers claiming, you know, a part of it, and they think or they believe, which is, you know, not true at all, that the Temple Mount, it's a Temple Mount, and the temple was there, whereas the Dome of the Rock now is there. And even since 1967, after the occupation of East Jerusalem, the Israelis started the try to find any evidence to prove this stupid story, which was not at all proven. They already dug more than 31 tunnels underneath Al-Aqsa and the old city of Jerusalem in different directions and in different elevation in order to find any shred of evidence to prove that the temple was there, and they couldn't find anything at all. However, they are still insisting on their part of the story that the temple was there, and they want to claim part of the Al-Aqsa Mosque as, you know, theirs, so they can divide Al-Aqsa Mosque not only time-wise, as it happens now, but also place-wise. So they are demanding the area called Bab al-Rahmeh, and the mosque there, or the area there, which the Palestinians do pray in that area. It was closed for a while by the Israelis, and the intention were, after closing it, to open it only for Jews. But the Palestinian force opening it, and now they are using it as part of the Al-Aqsa Mosque to pray. Now, the settlers wanted this area to start there and to bring their, you know, even whatever sacrifices and other things, and start doing some rituals which is related to Judaism. And in this case, they will claim part of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Well, we know that this extreme Israeli minister, Ben-Gvir, Shalit Katz, which needs to be brought into the conversation, he not only has been convicted for racist incitement against, obviously, Palestinians and Arabs, he also supports terrorism. And he has expressed support for Baruch Goldstein, who was an Israeli-American, maybe you know about this, who killed 29 Palestinians at the Ibrahimi Mosque back in 1944. I mention this because Saad Nim there mentioned the Ibrahimi Mosque, and I figured I could bring and introduce Ben-Gvir and his character into this and ask you the role that he's playing now when it comes to not only the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which he obviously wants for the Jews or the Israelis, but he wants, but it stands towards Palestinians. Maybe you can give us an insight into that.
Well, Ben-Gvir has made a career and is attempting to build a political empire on the backs of the most blatant racism, genocidal rhetoric, construction of apartheid settler colonialism against the Palestinian people. I mean, this is someone who doesn't have the slightest hesitation about calling for another Nakba. And essentially, you know, that's what Ben-Gvir wants to do in this position is, you know, he's just been given this new so-called National Guard force, which is essentially another, he's already in charge of the occupation police, where we just heard yesterday these release tapes of the head of the occupation police declaring that, quote unquote, Arabs murder each other and engaging in this blatant anti-Arab racist rhetoric, this time targeting Palestinians in occupied Palestine 48. He's already in charge of the so-called Israel Prison Administration, which the Palestinian prisoners were actually able to defeat a few weeks ago in terms of the attacks that Ben-Gvir was attempting to enact against their daily existence. And now he has a new security force that he's in charge of. And all of these are essentially, you know, terrorist brigades in the hands of Ben-Gvir against the Palestinian people. This goes hand in hand with the occupation army. And of course, Ben-Gvir is not a lone figure, but Ben-Gvir represents the true face of Zionism in front of the world. When we hear from Itamar Ben-Gvir, we're not hearing from some fringe figure. Instead, we're hearing from someone who has the authority to order and command the police forces of this settler colonial project, which is receiving $3.8 billion a year in U.S. aid and U.S. armaments and weaponry. There's no question that Itamar Ben-Gvir is a threat to the Palestinian people and a threat to the entire region, but he's not alone in that regard. He represents what Zionism truly is, that is a racist, colonialist ideology dedicated to the complete dispossession of the Palestinian people and the domination of the region for the interests of imperialism. And so, you know, Ben-Gvir is openly threatening another Nakba against the Palestinian people. And this is one reason why it's so urgent for people everywhere around the world to compel their governments to end their complicity in these ongoing Zionist war crimes against the Palestinian people, you know, by imposing an arms embargo on the occupation, boycotting the occupation, confronting these arms dealers that are selling weapons that are tested on Palestinian lives everywhere around the world.
I'm quickly running out of time here. I'm trying to forge a couple issues into a question for you, Saad. We're seeing condemnations pour in. Obviously, we've had one of the most prominent ones coming from Hamas. Also looking at Jordan, who requested an emergency meeting with the Arab League, which they held. And the Arab League has said the UN should convene. And some of the Arab countries, like Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, have sent words of condemnation. Of course, the Islamic Republic has also condemned the act that has occurred there inside the mosque. Are we looking at, and then I have to add to that, the fact that you even have the United States and where Charlotte Cates is, Canada, they've even come out and expressed their worries. I mean, for whatever that's worth. But at the same time, I think because the landscape is different with these politicians that are have been described as fascists, like Itamar Ben-Gvir, like Smotrich, why are we going to see anything come out of it? I mean, aside from condemnations, are we going to see them do something before more Palestinian lives are going to be slaughtered?
We've been used now to all these statements and condemnations, and it's verbal work so far. We need to have the Arab world and the Islamic world to do something, you know, tangible, something, you know, they can do and they can afford to do it. For instance, to boycott all companies that works in Israel, or to start making a kind of an economic pressure. They could do that without even bothering to go to war or even anything else. They can put pressure on Europe, for instance, that European, we are not going to buy from any of your companies if they deal with Israel, to bring back the boycott, which used to be in the 60s. And in that case, they do something. But so far, what we hear from the Arab world and the Islamic world, unfortunately, only the condemnations and some statements here and there. Now they are going to convene for the Arab League soon because of that matter. But also, we will hear again some condemnation. Palestinians are doing that on their own. We are, as a Palestinian, resisting the occupation, and this is the only way for us to do it. It's important for us, the international position, and I think that this stupid Israeli government is giving us every day, and the whole world, every day evidence that it is a fascist and it's a racist, colonialist regime from the very beginning, since 1948 till today, which based on hatred, violence against the region in general, and particularly against the Palestinians. They are prosecuting an ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian, and this ethnic cleansing is continuing since 1947 till today, and it's still going on. So we need the international community to understand.